Hello, everyone. Welcome to Tuesday Night Rheumatology. I'm Jack Cushman, Rheum Now. Thanks again for tuning in to our Tuesday night set of programs devoted to the content from Rheum Now Live 2024. Tonight's program is sponsored by Amgen. Tonight's program is focused on vasculitis. We have got three excellent speakers I think you're going to enjoy. In this next hour, we're going to show you excerpts of their great lectures at Rheum Now Live on Sunday, January 28th. I want to remind you that today's program is you're viewing here on Zoom, but is also going to be live streamed out to YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. So tell your friends they can watch us there. This is a series of programs, weekly programs, five in a row, dedicated to different sessions at Rheum Now Live. Next week, we're going to have a session on spondyloarthritis, the week after on lupus. Again, I want to thank our sponsor, Amgen, and we're going to get into the program right now. At the end, we're going to go over some of the questions that we sent you yesterday, quiz questions from this session on vasculitis. That's how we'll wrap up the program. If you have questions, please use the question box, not the chat box, and we'll answer your questions during the program. Our first speaker is Dr. Cassie or Catherine Sims from Duke. Cassie has a lot of expertise and interest in a number of topics, one of which is pregnancy. And as you know, Duke is one of the vasculitis centers in the country. So Cassie's going to lecture us on what is known about vasculitis and pregnancy. We're going to begin her talk where she's going to give you the approach to this problem. Take it away, Dr. Sims.
So I created this table because I wanted to demonstrate a few different things. Oftentimes patients will come to me and say, what are the chances of this? Can you tell me what my chances are of developing preeclampsia or having a miscarriage? And the reality is that we have extremely limited data, retrospective studies, systematic reviews, a single center, one country, not a diverse population. So it's very hard for us to generalize the outcomes of these studies to our patients. And as everyone in this room knows, vasculitis is so heterogeneous. So one patient with ILD is going to have different risks than a patient who has heart failure or pulmonary hypertension. So what I tell patients is there is data available. Sometimes they like to have the actual medical literature, so I will print them out an article for them to read. But the reality is look how wide-ranging the percentages are. And that's because the way that these studies define pregnancy outcomes and were those patients sick when they conceived? Were they diagnosed with vasculitis during pregnancy and not going into pregnancy with a known vasculitis diagnosis? That all makes a big difference in the outcomes of the pregnancy. So I try not to overwhelm them or make them anxious when it comes to the data because we really just do not know. So then the next question is, well, what are my risks of having a flare if I were to get pregnant? So the table shows the impact of vasculitis on pregnancy, but this is a bidirectional relationship. What is the impact of pregnancy on their vasculitis? And in women with inflammatory arthritis, when we see them in clinic, we have a tagline where we say 30% of women will get better, 30% will get worse, and 30% will stay the same. And so I kind of like to use that with my autoimmune patients because the data shows quite a range, but around 30 to 40% of patients are experiencing flares. Now, how did these studies define a flare? Was it worse sinusitis and GPA? Was it an ILD flare or progression? It's defined differently. So again, you have to take the type of vasculitis into account, how active their disease is when they conceived and during the pregnancy, in order to give them better insight into their risks of flaring. And I find that patients are very receptive when I say, I've looked at the literature and I would like to interpret the literature in your clinical context. And they appreciate that because then I can make an informed decision and give them the tools to make an informed decision about moving forward with pregnancy. So the answer is, it's certainly possible that you can flare, but let's talk about steps we can take to minimize the chances of a flare and optimize your pregnancy outcomes. The best pregnancies are those that are planned during times of quiet disease on pregnancy control, on pregnancy compatible medications. That is the take-home point from today's talk. So what I encourage rheumatologists to do is at each clinic visit, ask, do you want to get pregnant in the next 12 months? We actually have this, our MAs will screen the patient with a survey when they walk in the door, so we don't even have to ask this question. But no matter what the answer is, it's something that we can address. So if you do want to get pregnant in the next year, let's talk about how we can optimize you, get you plugged in with the right doctors so that you can have the best experience possible. And if the answer is no, then what are we doing to actively prevent an unplanned pregnancy? Patients with unplanned pregnancy and lupus have worsening maternal depression, and they also can have worsening disease, and that can lead to worse pregnancy outcomes because an unhealthy mother can lead to an unhealthy pregnancy and more complications. So, as their rheumatologists, we are focused on optimizing maternal health, and we all have the same goal. We want a good pregnancy outcome, and your role as the rheumatologist is monitoring disease activity and ensuring that you are plugged into that multidisciplinary team because you are the autoimmune expert. Maternal fetal medicine doctors are phenomenal and they are brilliant, but they are not autoimmune disease experts. You are. And no matter how good they are, they cannot replace that knowledge that you have. So my take-home point for rheumatologists is to engage in these conversations and to be present because your patients really appreciate it. The next question, if they do want to get pregnant, is how active is their disease? And oftentimes I have to show this to patients. In these conversations, and probably in a lot of conversations, you cannot just tell a patient something. You need to demonstrate to them and build a case on why you do or do not think pregnancy is the best decision at this time. So are they requiring glucocorticoids? Are they being hospitalized? Are they non-compliant with their medication for various reasons? And then the last question is, if they're interested in pregnancy and they were to get pregnant right now, are their medications safe in pregnancy? And we'll go through the different categories of safety profiles for our medication. So I like to create a checklist and when I see patients in clinic because it helps me to be comprehensive because these conversations, you know, they can be emotionally charged. These patients feel that family planning is a big part of their self-esteem and it's a big personal goal. And they're always afraid that I'm going to shut down that conversation or I'm going to shut down their personal goals. So I try to create a checklist so that we can talk about the risks and benefits. And oftentimes I'll have patients that still move forward with pregnancy, even if I've recommended against it for medical reasons. And I still stick with them through the pregnancy. And I say, I'm going to be here and we're going to troubleshoot and we're going to try to find solutions as we go along. And giving the patient a sense of control over their own reproductive health makes a big difference in the relationship with them. So confirming pregnancy goals and timeline, discussing their disease activity over the past year, documenting organ damage, and the last time this was assessed. And I have slides after this where I'll go through in depth each of these different checklist items. Reviewing medications. Does the patient have a history of blood clots or recurrent miscarriages? Do they meet APS criteria? Do they have RHO antibodies that can lead to neonatal lupus? And then discussing the role of aspirin as a preeclampsia prophylaxis. And last is referring them to the doctors that can manage them during pregnancy. I personally believe that all vasculitis patients should have a high-risk OB or maternal fetal medicine. And they may also need cardiac anesthesia, other subspecialists, so maybe cardiology, pulmonology, nephrology, just depending on what their end organ disease is. I tell them that they should let all their subspecialists know their pregnancy plans so that we can all give them input from our perspective. So looking at disease activity over the past 12 months, so I try to ask them, you know, how much of glucocorticoids have you required over the past year? And the reason I ask that is because in pregnancy, we try to minimize glucocorticoid use because it can lead to preterm delivery. So the higher the doses of steroids for the longer period of time can lead to pregnancy complications and also indicates underlying uncontrolled disease activity that we could potentially optimize with pregnancy-compatible medications that don't pose those risks of preterm delivery. Are they being hospitalized? Are they having to have stents placed for stenoses? These are things that indicate that we need to do a potentially a better job of disease control. Now, depending on the type of disease, I will have a discussion with them about baseline imaging. So for my Takayasu patients, we'll talk about echoes or CTA to see if there's been any progression of aneurysms. And that's because I have to remind patients that pregnancy is not a benign condition. Patients who get pregnant seek medical care because pregnancy is a medical condition that does pose risk to the mother. So it's important for us to understand the physiologic shifts in pregnancy, the expansion of blood volume, the stress that it puts on the heart and the kidneys. And in patients who have chronic kidney disease or a heart failure, pulmonary hypertension, those risks may outweigh the benefits of continuing with a pregnancy. So I'm always trying to assess disease activity at baseline as much as possible. And also, sometimes these tests can lose sensitivity and specificity in pregnancy. So inflammatory markers are no longer reliable. Pulmonary function testing can be affected by pregnancy as you progress through the trimesters. And also, we want to avoid CT imaging as much as possible in pregnant patients. I have done CTPEs in pregnant patients when we had a very high risk for high concern for PE, but that's after a risk-benefit discussion with radiology. So we try to avoid imaging as much as possible. So getting these at baseline is extremely helpful to stratify pregnancy risk. So if the disease is active in the last year, I would say, listen, the literature shows that we would like your disease to be quiet for 3 to 6 months on a pregnancy-compatible regimen before we consider conceiving. And the reason is because if your disease is quiet, we know that that regimen works for you, then we can continue it throughout pregnancy, and the risk of having a flare is much lower if we go into the pregnancy with well-controlled disease. There are some contraindications to pregnancy. I have had conversations with patients where I have said it's unsafe for us to continue with pregnancy, but again, not abandoning the patient. They can make their decisions and move forward. And what we do is we just plug in the subspecialist and we collaborate and we make sure that they have the best support possible. And like I said before, we also will have cardiac anesthesia and vascular surgery. I typically see the patients once a trimester at minimum. If they're very sick, then I will see them maybe every 6 weeks just to ensure that somebody is monitoring their disease activity. They may need to be hospitalized. So I do see them quite frequently, and I'm getting blood work and urine studies because sometimes preeclampsia can be difficult to tease out from our autoimmune diseases like glomerulonephritis from ANCA-associated vasculitis. So having a UPC that's trended over trimesters can give us a little bit more insight into whether there's a superimposed preeclampsia on top of active autoimmune disease. So this is my next polling question. So in pregnancies exposed to a teratogen, which of these medications has the highest birth defects and pregnancy loss? Jack, just to let you know, the timer's frozen up here, so just let me know when my time's up. Okay, great. Mycophenolate is the correct answer. Good job. Oftentimes, people think it's methotrexate, so great. I'm going to go over that a little bit later. So these are snippets from the handout from VPreg that we created to make it a little bit easier for patients to understand their medication safety profile. What I like to do is I print it out and I circle the medications that they're on so that they can see what's safe for them to use. So the dark green are the safest. These are strongly recommended, really good data. You can continue them. Sertolizumab, our TNF inhibitor, that can be continued throughout all trimesters. But other TNF inhibitors, we typically will stop around 32 weeks of pregnancy to prevent placental transference and fetal exposure to the TNF inhibitor. I will say that in the inflammatory bowel disease data, some of our GI colleagues are continuing all TNF inhibitors throughout all trimesters because the risk of a bowel inflammation and perforation outweighs the risk of continuing the medication throughout all trimesters. So it's certainly a discussion to have with patients. I also do not switch my patients from TNF inhibitors to sertolizumab from one TNF to another for pregnancy. If they're stable on their TNF inhibitor, I will keep them on that. Now, I have this yellow category, which is unknown, and we have a lot of new drugs that are really fantastic, but we don't have pregnancy safety data. Mother to Baby is a great resource where they collect information on accidental exposures in pregnancy. So I direct my patients there because that's really how we get good information. The boxed medications, I read this review of biologics in pregnancy that was published last year, and there's some animal model data that these medications that are boxed can cause fetal abnormalities or pregnancy loss, but those were in animal models with much higher doses than what we give our human patients. Now, as most of you correctly answered, so mycophenolate-containing medications have much higher birth defect rates than methotrexate does. And methotrexate is notorious for pregnancy loss and for fetal malformations, but mycophenolate kind of gets lost in that. And what we try to tell patients is accidental exposures can lead to up to a fourth of pregnancies having pretty devastating birth defects. There's an MREMS program where you can counsel the patients on how to properly use contraception when they're on teratogenic medications. Because as you can imagine, this is quite emotionally and physically stressful for patients to experience an accidental exposure and then have to decide about next steps in the pregnancy. Like I said before, prednisone is safe in pregnancy, but we try to keep it below 10 milligrams of prednisone to avoid any poor pregnancy outcomes. And then hydroxychloroquine, we'll talk a little bit later about Rho positivity, is also safe. NSAIDs we like to avoid throughout all pregnancy. And then rituximab, we'll talk a little bit later. I typically like to dose it around conception or during the first trimester to carry them through the pregnancy. If there's life or organ threatening disease later in the pregnancy, then you can redose it. But just know that there's a higher risk for a transfer through the placenta at that time. So,
Okay, thank you, Dr. Sims. Great presentation. Again, I want to stress that, she's dealing in an area with not a lot of data. And a lot of her recommendations are holdovers from other autoimmune diseases like lupus, where a lot of the rules, especially about pre-pregnancy planning and counseling, about, the checklists, referral to high maternal-fetal medicine or high-risk OBs, all makes a lot of sense. She does go into a little later talking about the appropriateness of continuing hydroxychloroquine, especially in people who are Rho positive. And that's important, I think, even
but one
for
of my patient
oops, for our best,
NSAIDs we like to
oops,
avoid through.
sorry, even for our vasculitis patients. So, okay, let's move on. Our next speaker is Dr. Anisha Dua from Northwestern University in Chicago. Anisha was on the program last year. So good, we had to have her back. This year, we asked her to tackle the topic of GPA management and modern management here in 2024. So let's listen up when she will have already given a case and now and given you a number of options to choose from. And while one was dominant, she basically says many of them are appropriate. And she begins with the next slide where she says, where these different therapies are appropriate in a newly diagnosed patient with GPA. Let's listen up.
So that's nice. There is data out there to support all of these regimens that I put up there. I just have up here the ACR guidelines and the EULAR guidelines, and I just want to point out a couple of recommendations from these guidelines and differences between the two. So for induction therapy in severe disease, the ACR recommends rituximab over Cytoxan. EULAR says you can use either rituximab or Cytoxan. In relapsing disease, rituximab is preferred. In non-severe disease, we say use methotrexate. EULAR says use rituximab. This patient has severe disease, so that doesn't specifically apply. Glucocorticoids, both societies recommend a reduced glucocorticoid pexavast regimen, and we will get into that a little bit later. And in terms of plasma exchange, the ACR recommendations are against plasma exchange in whether they have renal involvement or alveolar hemorrhage. EULAR says you can consider it in renal involvement, but don't use it in alveolar hemorrhage. All right, so when this person is in front of you, they're sick, they're really not doing well, you want to throw the kitchen sink at them, right? So what do you have in your kitchen sink that can try to get this disease under control? First thing we have, oh, okay, that's different than what I thought. All right, one second. So the first thing that we have is pulse steroids. There's no good head-to-head data comparing pulse steroids with high-dose oral steroids. I tend to use pulse a gram a day for 3 days in my sick hospitalized patients. The other thing we have in our kitchen sink is rituximab and cyclophosphamide. We know cyclophosphamide has been around since the introduction by Fauci and Wolf in the 1970s, and we know that there's a lot of toxicities with using long-term cyclophosphamide, but it is effective. And that has been partially or largely replaced for induction with rituximab, and that's largely based on the RAVE and Rituxavast trials. So again, cyclophosphamide, oral and IV, both are effective. There's a little bit more leukopenia with oral Cytoxan. And rituximab, importantly, use rituximab in, plus 2 doses of cyclophosphamide and compared that to cyclophosphamide alone. And that was in a sicker population. The RAVE trial was a cleaner in that it only used rituximab and compared it to Cytoxan, but these patients didn't have a creatinine greater than 4 and none of them were on mechanical ventilation. So those are just some caveats, but all of these are possible options. Now, what about cyclophosphamide and rituximab? So that's really heavy duty wiping out someone's immune system, right? But this study kind of went back at those three trials I just mentioned and kind of looked at whether how patients did, if they got just rituximab, if they got the combination of rituximab and Cytoxan, or they just got Cytoxan. And what you can see here is overall the patients did about the same, Again, you're going across different trials, so some, there's some issues there. But rituximab was actually slightly superior to the combination therapy in GPA patients. Now, this was a trial specifically looking at the combination of these two drugs. They gave Cytoxan upfront, rituximab a week later. A week after that, they got Cytoxan and rituximab. And then they got this kind of like Euro-lupus low-dose Cytoxan protocol moving forward. So a lot of immunosuppression. These patients were sick. You can see the GFR. Half of them were on dialysis, half had alveolar hemorrhage. All of them received plasmapheresis. And they did quite well, but there was prolonged B-cell depletion, low rates of relapse. I personally do not use this combination regularly. There's a handful of cases where I probably use the combination upfront, but it is an option. All right, so we're moving on to plasma exchange. Most of you are familiar with the Pexavast trial that was published a few years ago and really did inform the guidelines that I mentioned before. So these were sick patients, again, multi-center, multi-country study, a huge undertaking. And they were basically given standard therapy with cyclophosphamide or rituximab. It was dealer's choice, whatever the investigator wanted to use for induction. Then they were randomized to either get plasma exchange or no plasma exchange. Then they were further randomized to either get standard dose glucocorticoids or reduced dose glucocorticoids. Okay, so the questions that this trial tried to answer are, do we need plasmapheresis in these patients? Is it helpful? And can we get away with using a lower dose regimen of glucocorticoids? So D-PLEX or not D-PLEX, you can see here the primary outcome was end-stage renal disease and mortality, and there was really no difference between the people who were plasmapheresed and who did not get plasmapheresed. But when you go back and you look at this little subgroup analysis or post-hoc analysis, you can see that those who had a really high creatinine or that were on dialysis, you know, kind of hedges towards that favoring plasmapheresis side. It crosses one, it's not significant, but it just makes you think about if there's a signal there. And in fact, a few meta-analyses came out afterwards and looked at Pexavast and Mepex and some of the other retrospective and prospective trials and showed that plasmapheresis actually, in the meta-analysis, decreased the risk of developing end-stage kidney disease, but it didn't affect mortality, and there was more infections in patients who did get plasmapheresis. Okay, so just going on to the second part of this sort of trial, glucocorticoids. Can we get away with using less glucocorticoids? And this is just for reference. All the patients in this trial got pulse steroids upfront, and in the reduced dose arm, their dose was cut in half by week two. Not surprisingly, and they were tapered off. The reduced dose arm was basically down to 5 milligrams by 4 months. So not surprisingly, the reduced dose arm got less glucocorticoid exposure. There was an even amount of death and end-stage renal disease in both of these arms, and there were more serious infections in the patients on the standard dose regimen. So the reduced dose steroid regimen was as effective as the standard regimen for induction in ANCA vasculitis with less infections. This really shaped the guidelines for both EULAR and ACR, saying that we should use this reduced dose Pexavast regimen. Again, those little post-hoc analyses you can see here, there's a little bit of a signal in those patients who were on rituximab. Now, that was about 15% of the patients in the Pexavast trial. And again, it crosses one, but it just makes you question what's going on there with rituximab. This was very multi-country. So again, there was less access when this trial was going on to rituximab outside of the US. And so there was a lot of Cytoxan induction in this trial. So should I always do this rapid glucocorticoid taper? So at the ACR this last year, the French came out and told us, you know, here's what we found, and it raised a lot of eyebrows, or you know, shoulders or whatever. And people were wondering, you know, is this rapid taper safe? This is the guidelines, and should I be doing this in all my patients? Now, this was a retrospective study, and it basically was looking at the reduced dose glucocorticoid regimen from Pexavast that I just mentioned versus its standard dose. And this is real-world data, right? And they had a different composite endpoint. So they looked at death and end-stage kidney disease, but they also included progression before remission and relapse. And what they showed in terms of that composite endpoint, which is bad, is that 33% in the reduced dose arm ended up getting that composite endpoint versus 18% in the standard arm. So not really good for that reduced dose arm. Now, across the board, there was no difference in death or end-stage kidney disease. They also noted that there was no difference in serious infections, which was different than the Pexavast trial. And this reduced dose glucocorticoid, especially in the rituximab patients, increased the risk of death and end-stage kidney disease. You can see on the image there kind of the difference between the reduced dose arm and the not reduced dose arm or the standard arm. And the highest risk was those in patients who had an elevated creatinine and who were undergoing induction with rituximab. So let's just get a little bit into more detail about these two different trials and why there's maybe some differences here. We know one is a randomized controlled trial, it's highly regulated, and the other one is a real-world study. And so that's when people like stop being polite and start getting real. And so what does that information tell us about what we should do with these patients? So first of all, there was a difference in the primary outcome, right? One is end-stage kidney disease and death, and in the real-world study, they also included disease progression and relapse. Those are important things in our patients, so it is important to take those into consideration. In terms of induction, 15% got rituximab in the standard in the randomized trial in Pexavast, 71% got it in the real-world study, and all the patients in Pexavast were given IV pulse steroids, less in the real-world study. When we think about the standard regimen, it's really standard in a randomized control trial, right? So that's per protocol. In this other study, it was a mixed regimen. They had a sort of French taper, a portage taper, and a Pexavast taper. So there was differences within what people were calling the standard regimen. Patient population was a little bit different, you can see here. Plasma exchange, because Pexavast was looking at the role of plasma exchange, 50% of patients in each of those arms got plasma exchange. Whereas if you looked at this other analysis, only 13% got plasma exchange in the reduced dose arm, and 55% still got plasma exchange in the standard dose arm. So again, there's a lot more bias that comes into play when you're making a decision and you think the patient maybe isn't quite as sick. Maybe you choose not to pulse them, maybe you choose not to use plasma exchange, and maybe you put them in a reduced dose arm and maybe their outcomes aren't quite as good. So there's nuances there. So what do I do with these mixed signals? I tend to induce with rituximab a gram times two. When the trials were originally designed, it was based on lymphoma protocols, but 1 gram times two works. I consider plasmapheresis. I used to not after Pexavast, but now I think about it in my patients with severe kidney disease or who have come in on dialysis. I usually use avacopan as part of my induction regimen, so the standard versus reduced dose regimen doesn't play as much of a role for me. But if not, I generally follow the reduced dose Pexavast glucocorticoid taper. That's because guidelines are guidelines. They're to guide you, and they don't always apply for every patient. And so as I'm going down on the steroids, if someone's not doing well, then I'll adjust the dose. But I don't want to sort of jump to the other side just because of this other sort of abstract that was presented at the plenary at ACR. So in which of the following scenarios would you start avacopan? PR3 relapsing patient with severe disease, a GPA patient with worsening disease activity on prednisone less than 15 milligrams daily, limited GPA patient with refractory nasal crusting, I don't use avacopan. Interesting. So a couple of mixes across the board. This is a very beautiful, I don't know, example of mouse studies translating into therapies for patients, right? So we know historically from mouse studies that if you inject a mouse with MPO IgG, they develop a glomerulonephritis that looks exactly like ANCA vasculitis, right? But if you block the interaction between C5 and its receptor, or C5a and its receptor, either by blocking C5a or blocking the receptor or knocking out the mouse, and then you take MPO IgG and inject that mouse, they are protected from developing this glomerulonephritis. So this kind of translated into the CLEAR and CLASSIC studies looking at avacopan, which is a C5a receptor blocker, to see if there was efficacy and safety in using this medication. And it kind of led to this phase three trial, the ADVOCATE trial, which again, many of you are familiar with. And in this trial, they gave patients, regular standard of care induction with Cytoxan. Those patients were given azathioprine for maintenance or rituximab. The rituximab arm did not get maintenance therapy. And they randomized to either get avacopan 30 milligrams twice a day or a prednisone taper over a period of 20 weeks. And so the clinical endpoints here, what they found was that avacopan was not inferior to glucocorticoids in terms of remission at 26 weeks and was actually superior at 52 weeks. Not surprisingly, there was less glucocorticoid toxicity in patients who were not in the glucocorticoid arm. In terms of improvement in kidney function, the avacopan was non-inferior to the standard glucocorticoid arm, and numerically, you can see that there were some improvements. Adverse events were similar in both arms, and health-related quality of life was better in the avacopan group. Sorry, these slides got a little bit messed up. So post-hoc analysis that I mentioned in the other trials where post-hoc analysis kind of give you some signals or some worry. There was some post-hoc analysis presented at ACR this year. And you can see when they looked at subsets of patients with renal involvement or even significant renal involvement, like eGFR less than 20, there was actually no difference in terms of the efficacy of this medication. Patients with alveolar hemorrhage also reflected the original trial. When you just looked at the patients treated with rituximab, there was no differences. And also when you looked at a subgroup of patients who were elderly, more than 65, it mirrored the general trial results of the ADVOCATE study. So it didn't show any new, very concerning signals in some of these post-hoc analyses. Back to the real world. So this is some real-world data that was presented again at ACR this year. And in the original trial, patients were, brought down off of steroids, and the goal was to try to bring them off over about a period of 4 weeks. People did different things in the actual trial, but that's kind of what I tend to try and do is taper them down over a period of 4 weeks. But I usually keep them on 5 milligrams as my own practice for a little while. Anyways, in this real-world study, you can see that patients were decreasing their prednisone pretty quickly. And by 8 weeks, about half of the patients were off of prednisone. But even up to 24 weeks, there was still about maybe 20% of people who were still on steroids. And the mean dose here was 10 milligrams a day. So it was showing an improvement in terms of people coming down off prednisone, but they were still on some prednisone at, pretty far out from induction. And these are the two biggest kind of abstracts that discuss the real-world use of avacopan. And you can see here, one, I just highlighted some of the things that surprised me. I tend to use, like I said, rituximab for induction in most cases, but about half of the patients were actually induced with a combination of rituximab and Cytoxan. Again, a combination that I don't use very often at all. Maybe this is because partially this is going to be prescribed by our nephrology colleagues and they have trouble letting go of Cytoxan. So maybe they just want to use a little bit of both. I'm not sure, but my husband's a nephrologist, so I'm allowed to say that. But really, rituximab and Cytoxan, that was a pretty high use of combination therapy. The other thing was in terms of time to discontinuing glucocorticoids. At 8 weeks, 45% remained on glucocorticoids in one of the study I just showed you. At week 26, 8% were still on glucocorticoids. There were differences in terms of the rates of clinical remission, but there was still good, renal signal in Sebastian's study. Something that was interesting was that most patients were started on this drug as an outpatient, and there were some insurance barriers. The other thing is that avacopan was started in Sebastian's study like 8 to 9 weeks after glucocorticoid initiation. Now, in the trial, you use avacopan upfront right when you start the steroids. And I don't know if this is because of access on the inpatient side or people not really waiting to, waiting till they follow up with the patient and then deciding to prescribe it and then adding it on. So that will lead to delays, obviously, in bringing down the glucocorticoids. But again, so this is how in real life, they're not always using it the way that it was done in the trial. And there are ways to get the drug sooner for your patients. But it looks like patients were starting it about 2 months after they were actually getting induced. What about?
Okay. So, oops. Thank you again, Dr. Dua. She's going to go next into infections and prophylaxis for PJP, and we'll get to that at the end. Again, if you have any questions about these sessions, you can put them in the Q&A box. So far, we're just marching along. Our third and final speaker is the great Dr. Philip Seo from Johns Hopkins and the Vasculitis Center there. Dr. Seo's title was Treat to Target in Vasculitis. The bulk of his lecture was focused on treating giant cell arteritis and EGPA. As it turns out, there's not a lot of clear data on treat to target performance. Essentially, we all say that we're treating the target anyway, do we not? So let's get into Dr. Seo's, and he's going to talk about first giant cell arteritis, and we're going to end with a little bit on EGPA. Listen up.
Question number one is, has this patient had this before? Is this a new diagnosis of giant cell arteritis or recurrent disease? The second question you got to ask yourself is whether or not that patient has visual symptoms. And because this is a key clinical question, I think we have to go into a little bit of details in terms of the symptoms that you care about and the symptoms you don't care about. So the symptoms that are less concerning are the symptoms that we all have at the end of a long clinic day. So you've been sitting in clinic or signing your 2000th Epic note, And your vision starts to get a little bit blurry, right? And it's getting blurry for two reasons. The first one is because you're concentrating on the computer screen, so your extraocular muscles are getting a little bit fatigued. And the second reason is because you're looking at the computer screen, you're starting not to blink as frequently as you should. So you develop a little bit of sicca. And that's the kind of visual loss that a lot of people complain about when you're asking them about giant cell arteritis. But that's not concerning for us, because that's the sort of visual problems that patients that get better after the patient takes a break. The visual loss that we're talking about, or the visual symptoms we're talking about, really are things like amaurosis and field cuts, which I know you all know about. But I want to talk about some of the less common visual manifestations. The first one is blue vision. So when a patient first develops retinal ischemia from giant cell arteritis, there's a differential loss of rods and cones because the rods go first. And when that occurs, what happens is patients will notice there's a blue cast to things when they look at them, especially like white objects. So a white wall or a white board, they're going to notice there's a little bit of a bluish tinge. And that can be the first sign that the patient has visual involvement from giant cell arteritis. The second one is double vision. And the tip-off for that clinically is going to be that you're going to notice that the patient is tracking you by moving their head rather than just looking out of the corner of their eyes when they're looking at you move around the room. And the reason why they're doing that is because subconsciously they realize when they look all the way to the left or all the way to the right, they're developing double vision. And the reason why that occurs to giant cell arteritis patients is because there's ischemia to the extraocular muscles. So when that patient's looking straight ahead, there's not a problem. But when that patient's looking all the way to the side, one of those muscles is going to lag behind. So they're going to develop disconjugate gaze, which gives them that double vision appearance. Now, if a patient complains about double vision, but they're looking straight at you, that's also not giant cell arteritis. More likely than not, that patient just has a cataract. So it's nothing we're going to have to worry about. Okay, so there are two questions you ask yourself. Is this new or is this recurrent disease? And the second question is this does this patient have visual complications? And then I take that information and I put it into this particular approach. And this is traditionally the moment at which I stop so that you can pull out your camera phones and take a picture of the slide. Even though you all consciously know that you've got to copy your slides in the syllabus. So if any of you feel that impulse, feel free to let it go. But what I do with this information is I think if they've got new disease, they get treated with either weekly or every other week tocilizumab. If they've got recurrent disease, every week tocilizumab is better. For patients who have visual symptoms, I treat them with pulse steroid therapy upfront. For patients without visual symptoms, they get somewhere between 40 to 60 milligrams of prednisone. So think 40 milligrams for Taylor Swift size patients and 60 milligrams for Travis Kelce size patients. And that's pretty much it. So I think the surprising thing on this slide for some of you at least is going to be the fact that I'm now recommending tocilizumab for pretty much all patients with giant cell arteritis. And it took me a while to get to that point because I've been treating giant cell arteritis for a while. And for many years, I've treated these patients with glucocorticoid monotherapy. And I felt like I was doing a pretty good job for those patients, except apparently I wasn't. So the reason why I say that is because of the JACTA study, which, as you all know, is the study that led to FDA approval of tocilizumab for the treatment of giant cell arteritis. Now, this demonstrates the relapse rate in the patients who are enrolled in the trial. The top two lines represent the patients who are treated with tocilizumab. The bottom two lines represent the patients who are treated with glucocorticoids. And you can see from this graph how badly patients do if you treat them with glucocorticoid monotherapy, particularly the patients who are treated with steroids for only 6 months, because those patients have the highest rate of relapse. So I think this really drives home the fact that we can do so much better than steroid monotherapy for giant cell arteritis patients. Now, with regards to the frequency of tocilizumab, I make a differentiation between the new patients versus the recurrent patients. And the reason why I do that is because of this subgroup analysis from JACTA. So if you look at patients only had a brand new diagnosis of giant cell arteritis, again, we're looking at the top two lines. The top line represents the patients who were treated with weekly tocilizumab. The second line represents the patients who were treated with every other week tocilizumab, and you can't tell the difference. If you've got a new diagnosis of giant cell arteritis, every other week tocilizumab is just as good as weekly tocilizumab. So you can pick between the two of them. Now, for patients with recurrent disease, that's when it makes a difference. And you can see that in this graph, the patients who have relapsing disease do much better if they get weekly tocilizumab versus every other week tocilizumab. And that's when I think the dosing frequency really makes a difference. The recommendation for pulsed steroid therapy for patients with ocular involvement giant cell arteritis comes from the Vasculitis Foundation American College of Rheumatology guidelines for the treatment of giant cell arteritis. And as one of the people who participated in the guideline project, I can tell you this is not based on much. This is really based on not great data looking at the use of glucocorticoids for the treatment of giant cell arteritis, where they were able to demonstrate that pulsed steroids probably really help with reducing the overall reliance on steroids and reduce the risk of relapse. But we've never been able to prove that pulsed steroids actually improves the rate of ocular recovery. Now, the reason why I still recommend pulsed steroids for patients with visual symptoms is because I hate having that conversation 2 or 3 months down the road, where a patient asks me, "Doc, is there anything else we could have done to help me get back my vision?" And because I hate having that conversation with patients, I will often pulse in those cases, just so we're not taking second guesses about whether or not we should have treated that patient more aggressively. On the other hand, though, if you've got a patient who you really want to give pulse steroids to, but you can't convince them to go to the ER because they've got those Taylor Swift concert tickets in their hands, I don't want you to worry, because there's data from Southern Sweden that was presented to the ACR a couple of years ago that indicates that if you pulse patients with steroids versus give them oral steroids, you can't tell the difference. You can't tell the difference in terms of mortality, and you can't tell the difference in terms of visual outcomes. So the data that we're using to support the use of pulse steroids is really razor thin. Okay. You've got a patient with giant cell arteritis. You've got starting them in treatment with steroids and tocilizumab, or maybe not tocilizumab. What do you do then? Well, for me, it really depends on whether or not I was able to get that patient started on tocilizumab. So let's talk about the tocilizumab-treated patients first. So for the patients who receive treatment with tocilizumab, I try to get them off of steroids over 3 to 4 months. I try to continue tocilizumab for at least a year, and at that year endpoint, I basically ask myself, does this patient need to stay on tocilizumab? And the patients I keep on tocilizumab are patients with recurrent disease, patients with ocular symptoms for whom a second episode of giant cell arteritis could be devastating, and patient preference. Some patients would rather just not go through this again. They're tolerating tocilizumab just fine. There doesn't seem to be a reason to stop it. I'll let them stay on tocilizumab for longer. Now, when we get to the point where I feel like we're ready to start tapering the tocilizumab, I won't stop it immediately. I'll just start increasing the interval between tocilizumab injections till I get to once every 3 to 4 months, before, or 3 to 4 weeks, excuse me, before I stop entirely. Let's say you've got a patient who you couldn't put on tocilizumab. That's generally going to be due to patient preference or expense or contraindications to tocilizumab. In those patients, I think they need to be on prednisone for at least a year. And that at least, again, goes back to the JACTA data that seems to demonstrate that the relapse rate in patients treated with prednisone monotherapy is much higher in the patients who are treated with 6 months of therapy versus 12 months of therapy. Past that point, though, I kind of ask myself a similar set of questions. If that patient has a history of recurrent disease, or if that patient has ocular symptoms, I'll tend to taper them just down to like maybe 5 milligrams a day of prednisone rather than tapering them completely off. Now, this slide contains three statements that you guys might find a little bit controversial. So I wanted to go through some of the data supporting these recommendations. So, with regards to the fast steroid taper, this is a study that was published by Massachusetts General Hospital around the time of the ACR meeting, where they looked at 30 patients who had a diagnosis of giant cell arteritis, 15 new, 15 relapsing, who were treated with tocilizumab and a 2-month steroid taper. And they found that this regimen actually was remarkably good. These patients, sorry, the slide's moving without me. That's okay, we'll catch up. These patients were treated with tocilizumab for a year, and at the end of 52 weeks, 77% of these patients achieved a steroid-free remission with just 2 months of steroid therapy. Now, there were 4 adverse events, but the thing to remember here is that these patients may have developed these adverse events even if they weren't treated with tocilizumab. So I think overall, this is a remarkably effective therapy. The other reason why I think that this is an effective approach is because there is data supporting even shorter tapers of prednisone. So this comes from the GUSTO study that was presented a few years ago at the ACR and was updated at last year's EULAR conference. And the patients that enrolled in GUSTO had a new diagnosis of giant cell arteritis, and they were treated with a pulse of tocilizumab, 3 pulses of intravenous steroids, and then subcutaneous tocilizumab. And that's it. They didn't receive any more prednisone, prednisolone, no sorts of taper. They were just given that initial pulse of steroids and they were dropped off the cliff. And yet these patients also did really well. So of the 18 patients initially enrolled, 14 patients gone to remission. Of the 13 patients who were in remission at 26 weeks, or 24 weeks, all of them remained in remission at 52 weeks. So taken in sum, I think these trials are telling us together that the real gift that tocilizumab is giving our giant cell arteritis patients is the ability to get off steroids that much faster. Now, I talked about gradually increasing the interval between tocilizumab injections in patients with giant cell arteritis. And the reason why I do that is because of this really bad data. Hopefully, no one from Italy is listening to this conference right now, but this really bad data looking at the use of tocilizumab in patients with giant cell arteritis. So, this is a study of only 17 patients who are treated with tocilizumab for giant cell arteritis for about a year. And after a year, all these patients were in remission. So far, so good. They then decided to increase the interval between tocilizumab injections from once a week to once every other week. And they found that these patients had a 12% relapse rate. They then stopped the tocilizumab entirely, and these patients had a 24% relapse rate. The good message here is that that means that three quarters of patients did not relapse when you took them off of tocilizumab. The other important thing to remember here is that all the patients who had a relapse, they had minor relapses. They had like PMR, things that you would treat with a little bit of steroids. But it does indicate there's a dose response with tocilizumab in our GCA patients. And I'm hoping that by gradually decreasing the tocilizumab use, we can catch those patients before they completely fall. Now, the real answer to this question is going to come from the French. The French are conducting, as we speak, a trial called MAGICA that's going to look at different strategies for tapering tocilizumab in patients with giant cell arteritis. So hopefully we'll have real data for you pretty soon. Lastly, the last recommendation I want to talk about with giant cell arteritis is my tendency to leave patients on low-dose prednisone if they're not on tocilizumab, if I'm particularly concerned about them. And that's when this retrospective data looked at a large population of patients with giant cell arteritis and found that even low doses of prednisone seemed to dramatically decrease the risk of relapse versus the patients who are tapered off of prednisone completely. So I think that maybe 5 milligrams a day of prednisone is not much of a price to pay in order to get that little bit of extra reassurance, especially in that patient with visual loss but can't afford to be on tocilizumab for whatever reason. So now I want to move on and talk about EGPA. And for this, we're going to go through a second case. So this is a story of a 42-year-old man who 2 years ago started developing nasal congestion, decreased smell, and rhinorrhea. He then developed chest tightness, wheezing, and a cough. And the cough was so bad, he actually fractured a couple of ribs. 1 year ago, he started developing nasal obstruction due to hyperplastic polyps. And his labs were remarkable for an elevated eosinophil count and ANCA positivity. So what's the next best step in this patient's management? First is an urgent nasal biopsy to make a diagnosis of EGPA. The second is intravenous methylprednisolone. The third is intravenous cyclophosphamide. And the fourth is subcutaneous mepolizumab. Okay, terrific. And again, there seems to be a little bit of a spread with exception of cyclophosphamide. So that's great. No, this patient should not get Cytoxan. But let's talk about this. So traditionally, we think about EGPA as a triphasic illness, starting with asthma and then moving into a hypereosinophilic phase and then moving into a vasculitic phase. And I think this is a great mnemonic to remember all the components that are part of EGPA. But I don't think it's so useful when it comes to figuring out how to treat these patients. So, in order to treat patients, I'm going to suggest that you use a slightly different model. Peanut butter and jelly. I think that patients with EGPA really behave like peanut butter and jelly. They're basically two separate things that just happen to show up at the same time. So, the jelly in this case is the respiratory tract manifestations, and the peanut butter is the systemic manifestations. The respiratory tract manifestations really divide into upper respiratory tract and lower respiratory tract manifestations. The lower respiratory tract manifestations are just asthma, they're bronchospasm. The upper respiratory tract manifestations predominantly are going to be chronic sinusitis and nasal polyposis. For the systemic manifestations, you're thinking about manifestations driven either by eosinophilia or by vasculitis. For the eosinophilic manifestations, these patients develop symptoms depending on where those eosinophils show up. So the eosinophils in the heart cause myocarditis, the eosinophils in the lungs cause fleeting pulmonary infiltrates, the eosinophils in the gut cause eosinophilic colitis or eosinophilic esophagitis, and the eosinophils in the skin cause urticaria. And for the vasculitic manifestations, these are the ones that we all now know about. It's going to be Monorhizal multiplex, pulmonary hemorrhage, and glomerulonephritis. So with regards to initial management, these patients should all be on inhalers upfront. And the reason why I specified three inhalers by name is because these are the cheapest ones. These are the ones that the patients can get for about $80 a month. It is criminal how expensive inhalers are in the United States, but this is the best you can get price-wise. I typically will start patients with both inhaled and intranasal glucocorticoids when they're on prednisone 40 milligrams a day. Not because they need it at that point, but to get them into a routine. So they've gotten used to using these inhalers twice a day. So as I taper the prednisone, these steroids are starting to take effect. For patients who are continuing to have symptoms despite the use of inhaled glucocorticoids, I move to interleukin-5 blockade. I don't fool around with IgE blockade. I don't fool around leukotriene inhibitors. I go straight to interleukin-5. For these, remember that there are three interleukin-5 blockers that you can use. Both mepolizumab and benralizumab have been demonstrated in clinical trials to be effective for EGPA. The reason why you need to know about reslizumab is because insurance companies are evil, and some insurance companies will not pay for a subcutaneous biologic, but they will pay for an intravenous biologic. And reslizumab is the one intravenous formulation of an interleukin-5 blocker that you might be able to get your patient. So the reason why we use bembolizumab for the treatment of EGPA is because of the MIRA trial. And I just wanted to go through this Kaplan-Meier curve to remind you about the pharmacokinetics. So if you look at this graph, you can see it takes about 2 months for the patient to start to have a clinical response to mepolizumab. So if they don't have a response to that first injection, tell them not to give up. The second point is that it takes about 6 months to get a maximal response. So it takes a while before the patient knows the extent of the benefit they're going to get. The third point is that there's only a short honeymoon. So after the patient stops treatment with mepolizumab, after a couple of months, the effects are completely worn off and they're back to being the patient they used to be.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Seo. I thought that was a really good presentation. I think you can find Dr. Dua's whole video presentation on Room Now on YouTube, and I think you can hear all of Dr. Seo's presentation on Room Now on the podcast if you want to listen to the whole thing beginning to end. Let's finish up with the surveys that went out yesterday, answered by 250 of you, and see what you thought about some of these questions. And here is our the results. These went out yesterday. First question, rituximab and cyclophosphamide are equally effective for the induction as induction treatment in severe GPA. That's either true or false. And all of you, pretty much all of you got this right. 76% said that is true. And that is what basically Dr. Dua showed us. She showed us the data where they were both equally effective. Second question, also on GPA, is which of the following criterion carries the highest weight or most points in the 2022 ACR-EULAR classification criteria for GPA? And that was, the right answer was a positive test for PR3. Most of you did not get that right. All the other answers that were on, that's 5 points, by the way. All the other answers, including pauci immune glomerulonephritis and nasal crusting, sensory neural hearing loss, those are 3 points. So the right answer here was positive test for PR3 at 5 points. And the last question on GPA was for maintenance of remission in GPA, azathioprine is more effective than rituximab. And all of you got that right and said that that's false. Azathioprine is not more effective. Rituximab is the preferred maintenance therapy for people who've gone through induction and now need to be on maintenance therapy. Again, I think most of you did very well on these questions. The question that Dr. Dua was going to get into when we cut her off was this question about Bactrim or trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole prophylaxis in GPA patients. Well, it's used because rituximab, it's used with rituximab because the combination antibiotic does what? And the right answer was all of the above, meaning that it actually decreases the risk of PJP, but it also decreases the risk of serious infections and also decreases the risk of outpatient infections. That was based on a 919 patient cohort study where, again, there were multiple benefits to using TMP SMX prophylaxis. And the last question I'll cover for you, there were a few more, but I thought this was the interesting one. For patients with EGPA who present with respiratory symptoms such as wheezing and chest tightness, which is the recommended therapy? And the right answer was mepolizumab. And that was again had by almost 40% of you. Many of you chose steroids, which is more of a management for the systemic features, more so than the allergic features or the eosinophil driven features. When you have clear cut respiratory symptoms and allergic manifestations, mepolizumab is the drug of choice, and that is an indication there, obviously not Cytoxan and not azathioprine. So again, we want you to tune in the next 2 weeks, spondyloarthritis next week, lupus in our last week, at the end of April. Next week, our three speakers in a program sponsored by UCB is Eric Ruderman on non-radiographic AxSpA, Leahy Eder from University of Toronto talking about enthesitis and SpA, and Leanne Ginsler from UCSF talking about future therapies and advancing therapies in axial spondyloarthritis. We want to thank again our sponsor and all of you for showing up. You can find a lot of this content, a lot of our tweets and articles and videos and podcasts from this Vascular session being played out this week on Room Now. Tune in next week where we'll again get back into it talking about spondyloarthritis. Have a good night.